Good evening, everyone. We're broadcasting live November 11th, so it's an especially Buddhist day today. Or is that only in Canada? Is it a special day in America as well?
Today's Veterans Day in America.
Oh, you call it Veterans Day. Well, we have a better name for it, a very Buddhist name. Today is Remembrance Day.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's to remember veterans, but... yeah, probably shouldn't steal it. But it's in remembrance is a good word. It is good to remember, not to forget. Although in Buddhism it has a bit of a different connotation. Okay, we're doing Dhammapada. I really have to turn some stuff on. Test. Mic is good. I'm using the old mic, the one that failed on me before, because the new one's failing now. So tomorrow we're going to have a different layout. I think we're going to move into the outer room, which has a nicer Robin's idea that we move into the outer room. Something on the lens. You guys see that? The outer room has a nicer atmosphere. So we don't have to use this fake white. Okay, ready. Hello everyone and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse number 108, which reads as follows. Yang kinchi yitang vahutang valoke sangvacharang yajetha punyapeko sabampi tang nachatubhagameti abhivadana ujukate suseyo. Which means, it's actually a bit difficult because the grammar doesn't really work in English. So whatever sacrifice or worship there is in the world, if for 100 years, sangvat charang yajeta punya peko, one desiring punya, desiring merit, should perform such a sacrifice or such a worship. And yes, it's actually a very, very similar verse and story to the last two. Sabampi tang chatubhagameti. It doesn't come to a quarter of the value. All of that doesn't come to a quarter of the value. The 100 years of sacrifice or worship that one pays. Abhivadana ujugate suseyo. For the greater, in comparison to the greater abhivadana or respect or reverence that one pays to, and today our word is ujugatta, in regards to those who are ujugatta, gone to or become straight, those who have gained rectitude, moral or ethical or mental straightness, uprightness, those who are upright. So same story, we have Sariputta, and it's becoming apparent that he was really instrumental in helping a lot of his relatives and now his friends become enlightened. So now we have Sariputta's friend, Sahayaka Brahmana. A Brahmin who was a friend of Sariputta. Friend of Sariputta's from before. And so Sariputta went to him and asked him, do you do any good deeds? And he says, oh yes. What do you do? Oh, I offer sacrificial slaughter. And of course Sariputta doesn't see that as being a wholesome deed. This is about the crux of these three stories, is the idea that good deeds, our concept of good deeds, is often quite misled. And this even occurs in Buddhism. You'll see Buddhists performing deeds that they think are good deeds, when in fact they are perhaps useless, you know. So the case of, I've told this story before, but once we had a katina ceremony where I was staying, and all the villagers came together to do the katina ceremony. And so what they did is, they had this very important. I was in a rural area, so it was an area where people didn't have a lot of money. And there was one man who had built a house in the area from Bangkok, and he was quite rich. And so he got his rich friends from Bangkok to come up, and they put together a bunch of money, and they put the money up on a tree, and they brought this money tree to the monastery, and they wanted to do a katina ceremony. Well, it turns out half of them were drunk. They had been drinking, and the funniest part was, and what sort of made it a bit ridiculous, was that they didn't have a single robe with which to do the katina. So they brought this money tree, thinking, well, that's katina. Katina is a money tree, because that's really what it's become. It's all about money trees. Trees that are literally the made of money. The leaves are folded up bits of money, or just money sticking up on sticks. And so I said, okay, we're ready to do katina. What do we do? And I said, well, where's the robe? And they didn't have a robe. So I said, oh, well, can we borrow one of yours? And I said, okay. And I actually took off. Anyway, I don't want to talk about it. I'm sure it wasn't. Yeah, you know. Point being, not really what I would call a wholesome engagement, especially considering the alcohol involved. And the fact that after it was all over, they took the money back, and some of the half of the gifts that were supposed to go to the monastery, they took back for the village. It was really, it was a bit of a system that they had set up. And yeah, this happens in Buddhist circles sometimes, where we lose sight of, why are we doing this? I think while we're doing it, often they're doing it just because they're excited to have their village and their community grow. So the money goes to the community, I think, or I don't know. The stuff goes for the community. And they don't realize the great benefit to actually giving a gift. And in fact, they aren't really interested in giving gifts. On the other hand, there was that very same village ended up being quite awesome about giving alms. They there's another funny aspect of being there. I was staying with an old monk, two old monks. So this was later when I was staying with a second old monk, but I was staying with a first old monk deeper in the forest. And he told me, when you go on, he said, well, you can go on alms round to the village, but you won't get anything. You might get some dried noodles or canned fish, but that's about it. It won't be enough to eat, but you can go. And it was 3.5 kilometers walk along a dirt gravel road that was actually somewhat painful to walk. But I did walk 3.5 kilometers, and often had to walk 3.5 kilometers back, but not always. Sometimes someone going to the park, there was a national park near where the monastery was, would give us a ride back. Give me, or eventually us when I had followers. The great thing, once I went and they could see that I was interested in meditation and wasn't some crabby old monk, they were really keen on, and eventually the whole village began to give, and they really got this sense of the greatness. People who I think had never really gotten into it. And there was one man who was a really devout Buddhist and very interested in the Dhamma and very knowledgeable about the Dhamma, and we used to talk about the Dhamma, and he was really impressed. And he's, you know, he said, you know, this is a great thing that, you know, people who I've never seen these people give before are now into giving. So there was that. But that's really what it's about. It's the difference. These verses are about the difference between spiritual practices. We have this idea of spiritual practice in many Buddhist cultures of paying respect to gods or angels, and they've started making up angels. They've taken them from Hindu myths like Ganesha. People worship this monkey. The elephant god, and they have all these myths about Ganesha and Hanuman. In this same village, there was a woman who claimed to be a avatar. An avatar is a big thing in Thailand, and yeah, in Thailand anyway. An avatar for Hanuman, and of course Hanuman is this legend. It's a story, really. I mean, there's not even any ancient religious texts, I think, that have Hanuman in them. It's this tale of the Ramayana, which a fairly modern tale, and yet in India as well they worship Hanuman, or they seem to. They have monkey statues in front of their fields to ward away evil demons and stuff. But yeah, these sort of things, not worth a quarter of the, as he says, not a fourth part. Not chatubhagamiti. They don't come to a quarter. They don't even come to a thousandth part, as we were talking about in the earlier ones. Anyway, so he tells him this. It's a little bit different. He takes him. He says, "Look, you have to come to see the teacher." And he takes him to see the teacher. And this time, he actually says, "Bhante, please tell this man the way to the Brahma world." And the Buddha says the same thing. The Buddha asks him what he does, and he says, "You could do that for a year, yet it would not be worth the smallest piece of offering." And he says something also a bit different. Lokiya mahajanasa dinadanang. So if you were instead to give to the populace, you know, if you're instead to give to poor people, for example, that would be would be of greater value. So he distinguishes there, and it's an interesting point, because here the Buddha seems to be advocating giving of alms. That's what the English translation says, and that looks like what the Pali says, but it's something to do with giving gifts to worldly people. It's much better, because here he's slaughtering animals, which of course is actually unwholesome. But then he goes on to say, pasanna jittena mama savakanam vandantanam, to pay respect to my disciples, the Buddha says. The kusala jetana, the wholesome mind that comes, is far more powerful. I mean, I think he's quite understating the truth here, because honestly, sacrificing animals is not only a portion, it's not only a fraction as good, it's actually harmful. There's nothing good about slaughtering animals as an offering. So the Buddha is, I think, going a little bit easy on him. Because probably if he were to say, that's actually an unwholesome thing, then it would perhaps set the guy off and make him upset at the Buddha. So he couches it a bit nicer. He doesn't say how much less good it is than a quarter, but it's at least not, it's less than a quarter as good. It's actually harmful. And that's true of many spiritual practices. So again, as I've talked about, we have to be aware of the true benefit of our spiritual practices. We can't just think, I'm doing this and this is what people tell me to do, this is spiritual and therefore it's good. Spiritual practice can actually be harmful. You know, this was a spiritual practice that obviously was offering, killing animals in the name of God, that kind of thing. sometimes we take people who have the idea that taking drugs is spiritual, and I'm not going to go out and say that that's harmful, but my suspicion is that it has a great potential for harm, if not being outright harmful. I mean, I think a lot of people would say that taking even psychedelic drugs and hoping that it somehow is beneficial as a spiritual practice, I think some people would say that that is outright harmful. I'm not sure that I'd go quite so far, because there is an argument to be made that it opens up your mind to alternate states of reality. But I think there's a lot of delusion involved, like the idea that those states have some meaning or purpose or value, when in fact they're all messed up with delusion. And you know, I've been there, done that, and it's a mess of our mind. You know what our mind can come up with when it's doped up and it's high. No? So these kind of things, and you compare that, for example, taking drugs as a spiritual practice to a Buddhist spiritual practice of giving charity, or of even just holding your hands up and paying respect to someone who's worthy of respect. Why would, you know, who would think of that? It shows how far many people are from true spiritual practice. Many people say, oh, taking drugs, that's a spiritual practice, or doing expansive rituals or offering copious sacrifices or this kind of thing, doing very complex or very mystical things, maybe dancing. People say in the West we become very hedonistic with our spirituality, so maybe people say group orgies and karmic sex and that kind of thing, these are spiritual. Contrast that to the Buddha's idea of what true spirituality is: holding your hands up and paying respect. That is far more spiritual. So such a mundane seeming thing, but far more spiritual and far more beneficial, even just for a moment, than 100 years of dancing, spiritual dancing or spiritual music or spiritual sex, drugs, you know, all these things. So for someone looking for punya, which we all are, punya is goodness, even if we're just set on meditation, it's important not to become self-centered, you know, in the sense of me, I want to become spiritually enlightened. You know, enlightenment is about letting go, sacrifice, so it's a lot of self-sacrifice. An enlightened being will be able to give up anything. If someone asks them for something, they would have no sense of self, you know, of helping themselves. They have no qualms there. They consider what is proper to do and they do it without any attachment, without any greed. And they're very respectful. They honor those who have helped them. They're grateful to those who have helped them, that kind of thing. And they're very down to earth. So noble spirituality is like this. What's spiritual? Well, paying respect to those who are worthy of respect, giving gifts to those who are worthy of gifts, and mostly just being aware, being here, being present, being with mundane reality, understanding truth, true reality, and not being concerned with mysticism or altered states of existence or that kind of thing. Astral travel, anyone who's obsessed with astral travel, I mean, it's not to say enlightened people can't practice it, but people who are striving for that are really missing the point. Mahasi Sayadaw tells a story of a woman who he knew who was working very hard to try and see out of her ears. She was trying to gain the spiritual ability to see out of her ears. And he said, and this when her eyes worked perfectly fine. So we get often on the wrong path. True spirituality is often easy to mistake for ordinary reality. I always say that enlightened people are what we think we are. We all think of ourselves as living normally. We think of ourselves as normal, you know? But no, we're not. You know? Our defilements take us away from what we think we are, take us away from mundane reality. So I've made much of this very simple verse, which is very much like the other two verses, and I promise the next one is different. Still along the same vein, but it's a totally different context and story, everything. And it's a very, actually one of them, probably the, if not one of the, if not the most famous verses in the Dhammapada coming up next time. And then after that, we have the story of Sankicca, which is a very nice story, and so on and so on. Not all the stories are long. Some of them are very short, as you can see. Some of them are very long. I think the longest ones have already gone by, so we're not going to have great storytelling. Not all of it is going to be great stories. But always something new and some new message to be found in the Dhammapada. And of course, the verses themselves are things you can reflect upon. And what is important? This is the Sahasavagga, which is the thousands. So it's contrasting single things to thousands of things, for the most part. Thousands of something useless, better is one thing that is useful. So that's the Dhammapada for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Keep practicing and be well. Okay, hopefully that turned out. Now I have to turn some things off. It's like I had it on mute. It just asked me if I wanted to turn mute off. I wonder if I had it on mute the whole time. Wouldn't that be funny?
No, the comments from the chat panel are that the audio is great, but the camera did go out of focus a little bit on the YouTube.
Yeah, but that audio is different from this audio. The audio I was using, I don't think it was, it couldn't have been on mute, but that would be funny if it was. You know, I could do, for the Dhammapada portion, I don't really have to record a video. We could just do the audio stream for that part and start doing the live hangout after I do the Dhammapada. Because, I mean, why record? Then otherwise I have it recorded on YouTube twice. It'd be nice to have the videos be entirely different, right?
So, could you say that again, Bhante? You're going to do the Dhammapada and then do the hangout afterwards?
Yeah. Just okay. Do the audio stream during the Dhammapada so people could listen if they wanted. And if they want to watch, they can wait. And then we could put the, if you could get the, do you see the link in the bottom right corner? It says links.
No, that's only on the page of the person who creates the hangout.
Okay. So I can put the link in the, when people know to go there.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll think about doing that in the future. Are you, am I echoing you?
I don't think so.
Okay. Then, I don't need you loud, so I can even turn you down. Because that's not coming anymore. So, camera's okay? A little bit out of focus?
That's a little blurry. It kind of goes in and out.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. Questions? Do we have questions?
We have questions, yes. Why do monks chant? I ask because I have recently been shown a breathing technique where you breathe in through your nose and then exhale through your mouth, making an ah sound. This technique has been scientifically proven to benefit the nervous system. How exactly, I don't know, but it got me thinking about monks chanting. Has the West finally caught up with what the East has known for centuries?
Can you repeat that? It's been scientifically what?
Scientifically proven to benefit the nervous system.
Okay, right away I know there's a problem. Science never, ever, ever proves anything. Science can't prove anything. It can only disprove. Why I say it, because you have to be careful. I don't think this isn't quite your question, but be very careful when you believe claims that someone says something is scientifically proven. You can provide evidence in favor of something, but you can't ever prove it. So you can show what appears to be a link. And usually science involves taking lots of people and putting them through a trial and measuring the benefits. So then you have questions about how it was performed, whether it was a double blind, so whether there was bias involved, or whether there was some sort of because you know studies show that placebos are beneficial to people. Placebo meaning medicine that is just sugar; it's not medicine. But when it's given to people, so as a depression medication, for example, placebos work. I think it was they work as good as drugs or something. Sometimes even better. No, placebos don't, but nocebos do. Nocebos being being non-drugs, fake drugs that also have unpleasant side effects. So if a drug had unpleasant side effects, it actually did better, performed better, I think, than certain drugs. There was something, I mean, just ridiculous studies that showed that a nocebo performed better than the actual depression drugs. Because people thought they were taking real drugs. So the question is how much of a benefit, and how reliable is it to say that it's just beneficial? That being said, your question is different, right? Your question is, why do monks do chanting? How you relate it exactly to your... Can you clarify that for me, Robin? How is it related to this idea of saying ah or something?
Yes, he was recently shown a breathing technique where you breathe in through your nose and then exhale.
The idea is that the act of chanting might be beneficial to your nervous system. Is that the point?
I think so, yes.
Okay, well, that's not why we practice. We're not so worried about our nervous system. Not really at all, anyway, actually. We chant in order to, one, express respect and veneration and remembrance of the Buddha, but we also chant to remember the Dhamma, so that's to remember the teachings of the Buddha. So we chant and recite in order to keep them in mind. I'd say those are the two main reasons. There's another reason that people often chant today, and why probably most Buddhist chanting is done today, is as a protection, because people want this kind of physical and mundane protection, which is okay. It's just somewhat, clingy, really. It involves clinging if you're worried about. But lay people are rightly worried, and you know they have all these worries about protecting their belongings and stuff, and their life and their health. And so we're able to. It's kind of a kusala upaya, really. You tell people, well, these teachings, if you remember these teachings, it'll be good for you. And so they memorize, they recite these teachings. But actually the teachings will teach them how to be good people. It's sort of a basic means of giving people an introduction to goodness. Even though they're doing it to as a means to for worldly gain, for the most part. Like those people who pay respect to the Bodhi tree in order to get pregnant.
How about chanting when you don't understand what you're saying? Is that still of benefit?
I mean, if you're doing it for the right reason, right? If you've got a heart full of goodness. Like there was this, Ajahn Tong always talks about this bird that went to stay with the bhikkhunis, and they had it memorize atti, atti, which means bones, bones. I didn't even know what it was saying, but it kept reciting it. And it was so powerful that this eagle came and grabbed it. And when it grabbed it, the bird said, "Atti, atti," it spoke it out loud, and the eagle was shocked somehow by the power of the word or something. And the bhikkhunis sort of thought that this was indicative of the power of good words. And somehow that's in the commentary to the Satipatthana Sutta. Ajahn Tong always says that the bird went to heaven, but I don't think the actual sutta says that, or the commentary anyway says that. I don't know if there's a place where it does say that the bird went to heaven, but that would be a better story. And I think that's why he tells it that the bird went to heaven, because it had memorized this word, even though it didn't know what it was saying. So Ajahn Tong always gets us to memorize the four Satipatthana, and then he said, "Now you're as good as animals. You're all going to go to heaven. Good as all these animals who didn't understand what they were saying, but they still went to heaven. So all of you are going to heaven, but you're human beings, so you can do better than that. And so now we're going to teach you the meaning." And he gives this talk again and again, often says this. So he's very clear, and it's quite clear that if your heart is in the right place, doesn't matter whether you understand. He also would bring up that story when talking about us, back when I didn't understand, and whenever there were meditators coming to listen to the Dhamma talk, he always wanted the Western meditators to come and listen to the Thai Dhamma talk. He said, even if you don't understand, you're sitting there and you have a respectful mind, and you know that what's being said is Dhamma, is the Buddha's teaching. So good things come, you'll go to heaven.
Hello, Bhante. Why do we note sitting if it's considered a concept?
That's a good point. Because sitting is a description of ultimate realities, or can be seen as a description of ultimate realities. When you say sitting, you become aware of something present, which is the feeling of sitting, or the experience of sitting. Sometimes you won't notice that you're sitting. There's no feeling, or there's no sense when you're really still. But it comes from ultimate realities.
During sitting meditation, is the focus to be on the feeling in the body or noticing the action?
It's the feeling. I mean, the action is only apparent because of the feeling. So it's the feeling. Physical sensation.
And that's all the questions for tonight.
Okay. Well then, have a good night. Thanks everyone for tuning in. 34 viewers on YouTube. Hello everyone. Thank you for tuning in. It's always nice to see that people are still interested in this. Might have more going on in the future. I've thought about, I was just thinking about doing maybe once a week a talk on something a bit more directly related to meditation. But that might come in the new year, because I might be quitting university in January in order to do more teaching. So I could add more slots to the weekly meetings, because it's full, mostly. Anyway, for now, this is what we've got. So thank you for tuning in. Thanks, Robin, for your help.
Thank you,
bud. Good night, everyone.
Good night.